Quantum Reading versus the Rabbit Hole. There's an opening epigraph from Naomi Klein's book, Doppelganger. She says, "A state of shock is what happens to us individually or as a society when we experience a sudden and unprecedented event for which we do not yet have an adequate explanation. At its essence, a shock is the gap that opens between event and existing narratives to explain the event. Being creatures of narrative, humans tend to be very uncomfortable with meaning vacuums, which is why those opportunistic players I have termed disaster capitalists have been able to rush into the gap with their pre-existing wish lists and simplistic stories of good and evil. The stories themselves may be cartoonishly wrong, but at least those stories exist, and that alone is enough to make them better than the nothingness of the gap." Part 1. Much of what follows here will be an exploration of the human inclination to endorse inane conspiracy theories or join insane cults in favor of actual thinking. An inclination that is running more amok these days than at any other time in my life. The ongoing mass surrender of personal agency to a rogues gallery of seamy grifters and scary charlatans, Gog and Magog masquerading as Goofy and Mr. Magoo, appearing at first far too absurd to take seriously, but extremely dangerous for precisely that reason, given the series of shocks recent history has inflicted on the American experiment, the level of trauma they have induced, and the desperation with which so many now crave coherent stories, no matter how deranged, that promise not only to make sense of it right now, but to end the confusion once and for all. For a variety of reasons, I've been wondering lately how intelligent life, which is how we advertise ourselves to the universe, can be such gullible prey for the disaster capitalists Klein talks about. The reason she proposes is that human beings are very uncomfortable with meaning vacuums. But what does that mean? The kind of discomfort she is talking about is not physical, of course, but psychic. I'll take the liberty of translating it into anxiety, which, when it is intense enough, I know from experience, turns into a very specific kind of fear, one that can become vaguely generalized, especially when there is a meaning vacuum instead of a real threat. The effect is to feel under threat all the time, unsure from what, remaining always on high alert, brain awash with adrenaline, noradrenaline, and cortisol, that chemical soup designed to operate in short bursts, not as long-term addictions. After a while, the only way to relieve the discomfort is not fight or flight, which are appropriate responses to an immediate threat, but to run and hide, away from the nagging dread that chronic fear imposes. That's where the rabbit hole in my title comes in. A commonly used metaphor for the cults and conspiracy theories that are one of my targets here. To make my connection, I want to highlight the figure of the rabbit in this image. We've all seen video of rabbits running away from predators. Under those conditions, pretty much any hole will do for cover. If they find one that feels safe, they stay until the coast is clear. Then they come back out and operate as usual, case closed. Now imagine that rabbit feeling under such threat all the time, even with no predator chasing it. In desperation to relieve its instinctual fear, it will seek out the deepest hole it can find and dig deeper and deeper into it until it finally feels secure. Doesn't matter if it's a pleasant place to be or if there is a good way out. It stays. disaster capitalists, that is, many politicians, pundits, and priests, among other authority figures, know this instinctively. So they generate as much fear as possible, usually without much specificity. Then proffer their pre-made holes and invite the rabbits in, where they are more than happy to sacrifice personal agency to whoever dug the safe hole for them. There is, I know, an antidote to this generalized fear and to rabbit hole relief for it. But how to name it? I just couldn't come up with one that satisfies me. Last night I finished a complete first draft of this essay. Its working title was Off the Rails, which I knew was not quite right. This morning I woke up with the term quantum reading flashing in my head. Based on long and considered experience, I trust my dreams implicitly to help me solve my most intractable problems. That term struck me at once as both perfectly on point and pretty preposterous, and I couldn't decide which to go with, pitch it or ditch it. One of the primary features of quantum phenomena, in the material world at least, is a simultaneity of seemingly contrary, even contradictory, conditions or states. The particle-wave duality that photons and electrons express is the ur-example of this. What in a natural state is always both becomes, at the moment of measurement, one or the other, depending on what question the experiment is asking. I could see that I had already laid out a number of such anomalous concepts along the way: systems-level thinking, stacked reading, mystery, negative capability, creative irresolution, and non-contradiction, among others. What I needed was an overarching metaphor to unify them. Quantum reading seemed just the ticket for that. So there it is now, leading my charge in a title that sounds more like an MMA cage match than an academic article. I know enough about quantum mechanics to know that quantum reading is a stretch. By the same token, the term quantum has entered the popular lexicon in ways that broaden its application considerably. I'm taking advantage of that definitional flexibility to deploy the term in this new way. I want to open with a unique and illuminating reading experience I had last month. All of a sudden, in late October, I went from having no books on my docket to 5, each of which looked really interesting to me. They were 2 books by Celis Glendening, Off the Map, An Expedition Deep into Imperialism, the Global Economy, and Other Earthly Whereabouts, published in 1999, a semi-autobiographical narrative manifesto concerning the deleterious effects on indigenous people of unscrupulous land rights practices in New Mexico, and My Name is Celis, and I'm in Recovery from Western Civilization, published in 1994. A book she says she wrote, quote, as a mental health professional who has researched personal issues of healing and recovery, as well as global issues concerning the psychological impacts of environmental disaster. Both of these books recommended by a friend. There was Elaine Pagel's The Gnostic Gospels, published in 1979, one of the first deeply scholarly treatments of the lost gospels that were unearthed in Egypt in the 1940s, a current passion of mine, as you know, if you've read my most recent book, Waking Up, Reading Wisdom Texts. This book also suggested by another friend. And there was The Selected Writings of Mikhail Bakunin, a 19th-century lapsed Marxist-turned-anarchist whose name I just happened upon provocatively in a review of Pagel's book. And finally, The Banished Immortal, A Life of Li Bai, published in 2019. Ha Jin's biography of the 8th century Chinese poet Li Bai, who was Li Po in Western culture, a favorite poet of mine, the book sent to me by a friend. I figured I'd read a bit of each to decide which to focus on first, then stage the others going forward. They were all so captivating to me, though, each in its own way. I just couldn't pick one. So I ended up reading them all simultaneously, 10 or 15 pages of one, maybe a chapter of the next, and so forth, night after night, for a couple of weeks. I have often previously read a series of disparate books in sequence, divining a commonality among them, one that would not be evident if the books were approached discreetly. This is the first time, though, I've intentionally stacked that process into a singular event. Very shortly, a wonderful thing began to happen. I'd be in the midst of one, and I would think I was still somehow in the midst of one of the others, or occasionally all of the others. It was as if I was not reading five separate books about widely divergent subjects set in vastly different contexts, but one book with five different facets. I began to wonder, how could that possibly be? There were no obvious resemblances in authorial style. Even the two Glendinning books were quite different. And the book's themes, historical moments, and ideological imperatives had nothing specifically in common. If I drew a Venn diagram with those various circles, there would be very little, if any, grayed-out overlap at the center. So what was it, I wondered, that led me to this peculiar sense of simultaneity? After I read this way for a while, that is, from what I now call a systems level, which is a concept commonly used these days in relation to biological, social, and institutional complexes, which is most generally the capacity to examine complex part-whole relationships holistically, from an organic rather than a mechanical point of view. So after I'd read this way for a while, I could see that what these books shared at their respective cores was a very basic premise. The belief that current and seemingly intractable cultural dysfunctions could be traced back to a specific tipping point in the past when things started to go badly wrong, though each located their preferred tipping point at a different moment in time, anywhere from centuries to many millennia ago, sometimes precipitated intentionally, sometimes inadvertently, sometimes via broad cultural shifts, sometimes via individual initiatives. They were not then, taken together, simply a congeries of alternate blame narratives for the current state of affairs, but felt representative at this deeper level of a stereotypical habit of mind that seems perpetually to afflict generational thinking, which is, things would be way better now if this or that had not happened somewhere along the way, as in before my time, to set them awry. And I need to try to figure out when and why. Counterintuitively, the practical effect of this was to force me to focus on the present moment as both intensely real, that is, immediate, local, exactly what it is, no matter how it got this way, and fully negotiable. So how, if at all, can it realistically be altered going forward? Rather than to lament that it is not what it should be, the only real solution going back in time for a mulligan, which is not yet, I'm sure, for the best, a technically feasible option. If there were this many different ways of explaining how things went off the rails stacked at my bedside, there were likely many, many more. And picking one felt more like blowing smoke into a smoke-filled room than finding the smoking gun. At impasses of this sort, when we believe that things are wrong and there seems no obvious way to set them right again, we have a decision to make. We can throw up our hands in despair, or plot out some path forward that, while not ideal, is at least potentially productive. Whichever of these we pick, though, there is an even more consequential choice to make. Whether to turn over our allegiance and our energies to an outside agent to provide an already packaged narrative purporting to make sense of the problem-solution paradigm, often these days some conspiracy theory or cult, among the latter of which I will include, unfairly you might say, though I don't, most organized religions, especially of the fundamentalist ilk. Science, whether as overly valorized or demonized via the popular media, and all party-line political ideologies, from mainstream to delulu, which is a slang term for delusional that I happen to see online and actually like quite a lot. Or we can assert personal agency via what I call actual thinking above, which begins in chaos and moves grudgingly toward narrative, if it ever arrives there at all. The former requires almost no work, research, fact-checking, new knowledge formation, time, or these days, with audiovisual social media, the information source of choice, even reading. Just opening the spigot and glug, glug, glugging whatever it proffers. Thus its appeal. The latter requires all six of those, and then some. So where does each of these books locate the pivot point toward our current dysfunctions? Glendening identifies the problem materially, specifically how the meaning of land changed as it moved from an unbounded reservoir of vital resources for the sustenance of early human communities to the individually owned properties typical in Western societies. She adheres to the now commonly held theory that this transition began to occur millennia ago, as humans turned away from hunting and gathering as their mode of survival, which requires constant changes of venue, therefore no excessive attachment to specific bits of land, to farming, which requires sustained settlement in a fixed place and significant investments of energy and resources that then necessitate such attachment. In the latter case, the argument goes, one needs to mark off one's territory and protect it from others. In other words, own it. This land protection strategy gradually evolved into the plot-based system of land management typical in the European societies, which traveled with them as they colonized the rest of the off-the-map world, enforcing their conventions for owning land as modes of cultural privilege, a process that can involve anything from buying it with trinkets to displacing with violence whoever happens to be on that land at the moment. Off the Map reports specifically on the insidious effects of such land rights practices in New Mexico, Glendinning's home at the time, via the many kinds of duplicity, chicanery, fraud, and when necessary, forced displacement that has affected the gradual translation of indigenous native land over to white settlers. My Name is Chellis offers a more theorized view of these matters, some of which derives from her professional experience as a psychologist, some from her background in feminist cultural studies. Both books are grounded in her personal experience as a child who was sexually abused in a grievous way by her own father, which in some ways becomes a metaphor for the many other kinds of rape that patriarchal empires inflict on land and those who inhabit it. Bakunin locates the problem immaterially in the ways we think about and relate to God, most particularly the God of Abraham, the transcendent creator who stands at the headwaters of all three of the major Western religions, Jewish, Christian, and Muslim. For Bakunin, given his Marxist roots, This God is an entirely human invention that inevitably displaces authority out of human hands and into a transcendent nethersphere, a move that not only disables collective earthly enterprise for practical betterment, but also insidiously provides the template for authoritarian political systems, especially class or caste-based hierarchies that create mega-power and mega-wealth at the top of the pyramid at the expense of the working classes at the base. The logic for this analysis is pristinely Marxist. Think of his opiate of the masses trope, for example. Familiar, lucid, and persuasive. And his case is surprisingly well documented. He understands European dialectical philosophy quite deeply, of course, but he is also well-versed in biblical literature and history. What interested me most, though, was Bakunin's eventual turn away from Marxism, arguing that as Karl Marx became more and more domineering in his approach to what the dictatorship of the proletariat would look like in the shorter term, which by most accounts he did, egomaniacally, over the course of his life, Marxism itself began to replicate at a structural level the very God problem it purported to override. Bakunin doesn't say this specifically, but he implies that any calling card that has dictatorship in its mission statement will ultimately be used to justify not a transitional, but a permanent authoritarian system that simply remolds the God top power pyramid into a different template. A worldly state, overseen by a few human gods, dictators cum oligarchs, a privileged aristocracy of overlords, flourishing extravagantly at the expense of the masses, instead of by one transcendent God. Bakunin is writing this well before the Russian Revolution and the creation of actual communist states in the 20th century, which turned out, in most cases, to become exactly what Bakunin predicted they would. The mode of anarchism Bakunin endorses is surprisingly cogent and orderly, a systems-level approach to non-authoritarian social reforms, quite unlike the forms of anarchism we are familiar with these days, whether from the left, Antifa, for example, or the right, Proud Boys, for example, many of which are violent more for the sake of generating chaos than reform. Pagels also locates the problem in the God matrix, specifically during the Romanization of the Catholic Church in the 4th and 5th centuries, as the church bureaucracy decided how exactly to organize the relationship of authority between the individual practitioner and the clergy. Finally, ultra-valorizing the latter over the former. This required resolving two impediments to unanimity, establishing the exact nature of the divinity of Jesus, which turned out to be quite a prickly logical problem, and codifying a universally orthodox Bible, which involved excising with prejudice via the heresy route all alternative views competing with the newly minted orthodoxy, their books banned, buried, or burned in the process. In other words, to create a religious system mirroring the Roman imperial system, power-based, with which the Catholic Church was now allied, universal, patriarchal, hierarchical, and vainglorious. Among the many casualties in this process were the Gnostic Gospels, which generally favored individual enterprise over externally imposed authority in spiritual matters. We now call these the Lost Gospels, most of which remain so until they were unearthed by accident in the mid-20th century. It might be more accurate to call them, though she doesn't, the Disappeared Gospels, given the extreme forms of censorship that excised them not just from the canon, but from material existence. Had not the Nag Hammadi trove been buried, most likely in the 4th century, the vast majority of this material would not be available to us in any form at all. given that we are living through a similar kind of censorship era, ranging from cancel culture to, more recently, rabid book bannings. There is an air of currency about this now long-forgotten example of the purgation of alternative ideologies in favor of an externally imposed orthodoxy. The outlier book in this group was obviously the biography of Li Bai, who is Chinese. All of the other books focus on Western culture exclusively, and was about an individual life, not a tradition of ideas, a movement, or a paradigm shift. What made this an interesting counterpoint in this five-piece puzzle was how, in my mind at least, Bai embodied the larger-scale problem in his singular life, which was riven by the competing aspirations that his own culture at the time made irreconcilable by definition. His public ambition, a deep and fierce one, was to make a name for himself in the upper echelons of the military and political hierarchy in China at the time, an almost inescapable masculine trope in all patriarchal cultures, East or West. Early on, Bai used his astonishing abilities as a writer and his very large personality as devices to pursue such a rise in status. These skills did usher him into circles of wealth, privilege, and power, but as his biographer makes clear, he ended up always being perceived more as an entertainer or a mouthpiece, a tool for aristocrats to use to further their personal ambitions, most often at the expense of his. In short, despite a lifetime of earnest pursuit of his goal, he never achieved any permanent position or commission. There was always, inevitably, a falling out that left him once again adrift, on the road to somewhere else, living off friends. The problem, in most instances, was a combination of his creative genius, which made him intolerant of the shallow and calculative stupidity that regulated public life, and which those in power found just as threatening as they did alluring, the former winning out sooner or later over the latter, or his expansive ego, which he was chronically unable to temper in the company of lesser mortals, often offending them. And finally, his uncanny ability to pick the wrong side of whatever conflict or intrigue he found himself enmeshed in. Bai's private ambition, on the other hand, was to become a legendary poet, living a reclusive life in the service of his work. Another common trope for creative geniuses in cultures like his or ours, that work hard both to celebrate their work and to keep them safely neutered on the sidelines. The old, pretty cool, but too hot to handle conundrum. Those two halves just don't work together, obviously. His life was then a series of chronic failures in personal terms while he was alive, and the achievement of extraordinary fame in historical terms, mostly after his passing. As Jin explains, for decades, Bai had been torn between two worlds, the top political circle and the religious order, but he had been able to exist in either one. In his own words, he says, "Trying to be prosperous and divine, I have simply wasted my life pursuing both." He had imagined each world as its own kind of heaven, where he was unable to remain because he was doomed by his love for both. So Bai traversed two paths simultaneously and was incapable of choosing, though it is telling that Jin and Bai in his poetry characterizes only one of them as divine. He fits into the cohort I'm writing about here as a good example of what happens to someone with great creative gifts when they are unwilling or unable to be absorbed into or to submit to the dominant ideology of the moment. Established and taken for granted cultural systems simply do not reward the most incisive forms of internal critique. And I was inclined temperamentally both to deep insight and naive honesty, at least not with the kind of advancement Bai craved. In other words, he is akin to the lost Gnostic Gospelist Pagel's documents, the marginalized anarchist Bakunin speaks to and for, and the indigenous locals being fleeced of their land rights over and over by white settlers in Glendinnings, New Mexico. All always shoved to the fringes, cast adrift on the outs. Everything they say may stake a claim to truth, but that is never enough to win the day in a cultural economy where power is the dominant, often the only, currency. Speaking truth to power, a common cliché these days, simply cannot work then or now when one's interlocutors do not believe in even a flimsy, diaphanous truth that transcends or subtends their self-interested discourse. Truth stands relatively firm in its relationship with language and thinking. Flummery floats around wherever its momentary purposes are best served, like those untethered statues Socrates assails in his vituperative argument with Meno. No historical moment in my lifetime demonstrates this dissociative tendency, discourse intentionally detached from evidence, fact, reason, or logic, all truth-related mechanisms, better than the one we're enduring right now.